I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Last week, we discussed what I consider to be the best Fantastic Four movie ever made, The Incredibles. This week, we are taking a look at the Fantastic Four movie from 2005, which came out a year after The Incredibles did.
Yeah, this is part of what they are now calling the Marvel Legacy.
Pretty much anything that's not MCU.
Yeah. These are the Marvel movies that were made under Marvel, not studios, but the Marvel brand licensed out to other film studios, primarily Fox and Sony at the time, prior to the creation of Marvel Studios and the later merger with Disney.
So, yeah. But that early 2000s was a very prosperous time for superhero movies because it established them as big blockbuster events. We had the first X-Men movie, we had the first Blade movie, the first Spider-Man movie, cemented comic book movies to kind of what they are. You know, they're the big summer blockbuster. They're the ones that people got to see. And we're still having that today. Although we mentioned it last week, there are people who are kind of going through a bit of a superhero burnout. But back then, we didn't really get as many superhero movies as we were getting now. So they were the must-see events.
Yeah, I think the people who are complaining about the superhero burnout do not remember when you could not see a superhero movie, especially a good to decent superhero movie, for life nor money.
I mean, now we're getting one every 4 to 6 months. Before, you had to wait years.
Yeah, and the going wisdom in Hollywood was maybe you occasionally get a Batman, like a Tim Burton Batman, and that turns out to be really good and people like it, but that is the absolute unicorn of Hollywood. Everything else is garbage. You know, Yeah. You get your Donner Superman or you get your Burton Batman, and those are an absolute unicorn. It comes along once every 20 years, maybe. And people go, ooh, look, someone made a good superhero movie. But that never happens. Everything else is B-movie trash.
Yeah. And your Captain America's with the Spanish Red Skull, or your Doctor Strange TV movie, or what, or your Roger Corman Fantastic Four.
Yeah, let's talk about that for just a brief second.
Yeah, because we cannot talk about this movie without talking about the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie. So
Oscar Haver Roger Corman, thank you very much.
Oscar Award winning Roger Corman.
Well, it's
honorary.
It's more an lifetime achievement Oscar winner Roger Corman, but it counts, damn it. Do you have an Oscar in your house? No, you do not.
I bought one at an LA gift shop once.
Yeah.
But anyway, so going back to the 1980s, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing his name right. Bernd Eschlinger had purchased the rights to do a Fantastic Four movie in the 1980s with a 10-year deal to make a movie. We were at that point, we're reaching 1992. A movie had not been produced. He had asked for an extension. Marvel did not grant one. So he was able to make a low budget Fantastic Four movie with Roger Corman in what is commonly referred to in Hollywood as an ash can movie. A movie that has no intention of being released and is only made for really to keep rights of things. And that's what Roger Corman's Fantastic Four was. It was a movie that was made for the sole purpose of keeping the rights to the Fantastic Four. The movie was never meant to be released, even though they released a trailer in theaters. The actors went on a publicity tour. There was all of this hubbub over this Fantastic Four movie. Was made for, what, $1 to $5 million?
I think that Roger Corman actually thought it was going to be released. I think the producers didn't intend to release it, but I think Roger Corman and all the actors fully expected it to be released.
I mean, they made a whole documentary about it, a very good documentary if you haven't seen it.
I think it's called Doom. I think, you know, the movie is available on YouTube and stuff because it's kind of one of those that's just in the rights limbo of nobody really owns the rights. And so it's, you know, there's lots of just copies of it. Now, it used to be the big hit of the convention circuit of, you know, people gathering in rooms and playing it, you know, at midnight at a convention in some hotel room.
That and the Star Wars holiday special.
Yeah, you know, back when those were the only ways you could see things like that. You know, somebody with, you know, a duped VHS copy. So it is worth watching if you're a media history completionist and you're just interested in these kind of weird little lost media things. I would recommend to people that if you have any kind of interest in the history of Marvel and how films are made and just goofy kind of films, because the people who made it really did put their heart and soul into it. We talked a few weeks back in a different episode about the things Warren Beatty puts out every few years to keep the rights of Dick Tracy from reverting to anybody else out of spite. He intentionally makes those awful and unwatchable because it's a spite project for him. This was not a spite project for anybody. I mean, the producers were just, here's a micro budget for a movie like this. You know, they threw minimal money. But the people involved in it were legitimately trying to do a good Fantastic Four movie. And despite everything that was put on them to limit their ability to do that, they really, really tried.
And it's very comic book accurate.
Oh, yeah. No, they really did their homework. And you can say what you want about Roger Corman and the types of films he does. Roger Corman is one of the people I respect most in the film industry. He is a legitimately incredible filmmaker who puts his all into everything he does. You know, you can fault him for a lot of things, but Roger Corman is a truly workhorse sort of guy. So if you put him on a project, he's gonna give it his all. And he really did on that project, and it comes through. So yeah, it's very worth going looking up and seeing it. And we've chosen not to talk about it more than this little backstory here for various reasons for this podcast, but I really, really admire what he attempted to do, and I really admire what the actors attempted to do, and all the behind the screen kind of people there.
That Thing costume in that movie, it's on par with, I would say, the 90s Ninja Turtle costumes, with how flexible it was and how expressive it was for such a low budget movie.
Yeah, never ever talk down about the ingenuity of people working on low budget films, because they will surprise you with, you know, how inventive they are at making that budget stretch.
The rights would eventually be sold to 20th Century Fox to make a big budget blockbuster Fantastic Four movie, which is the one we are talking about today. Which is why Disney has them now, since they bought 20th Century Fox. So we have our usual producers. Avi Arad, who has been a longtime Marvel producer, has pretty much been the producer on damn near every Marvel movie ever made. Well, you know, some people like him, some people don't, but, you know, he's been the producer, you know, he's the guy that was pushing for the Spider-Man movies and the X-Men movies and all that stuff. So he's always been, like, one of the main producers on the Marvel side of these movies. Originally, they wanted Chris Columbus to direct this movie. However, he decided to just be a writer, and it went through many directors before we end up with our final one. Michael France, Peter Siegel, Sam Wiseman, eventually getting to Peyton Reed, who we have talked about before because he was the director of the Ant-Man movies.
We talked about how this was his first foray into the Marvel zeitgeist, I guess.
Yeah. And you can kind of see some similarities in terms how action scenes are shot and whatnot between this and the Ant-Man films.
Yeah, interestingly, one of the people that was supposed to direct the film at one point was actually Sean Astin, who had never directed a film before.
Oh, Samwise. Our favorite Goonie.
Yeah. And the thing is like, he wasn't really like a big, like, Fantastic Four fan either. He just wanted to be like a director, and he was like, well, this is probably gonna be a big hit because people like comic books and Fantastic Four is a big property, and maybe that should be the thing I start with. I'm not really sure that was probably the way he should have gone with that, so I'm kind of glad we didn't get that.
He wanted Christina Aguilera to play the Invisible Woman.
He also thought that maybe Cameron Diaz should do it, which is at least a choice I could understand in 2005.
I just find it weird that we had Christina Aguilera, Cameron Diaz, and we end up with Jessica Alba. So it's like there was always this plan for having a Latina in the role of the Invisible Woman.
It was weird because when it comes to the cast, so many people were up for various parts, and some of them would have made very interesting choices. Like one of the people up for, you know, we eventually got Michael Chiklis playing the Thing in here, which I do think was a good choice. And even at the time, I was like, oh, okay, I can see that. But one of the other people that was kind of in the final small running was supposedly John C. Reilly, which I cannot picture
If they were going to make the thing a, if they were going to make the thing a comedic character, maybe.
Well, I mean, Ben Grimm has always had wit to him, but I don't think it has ever been the same kind of wit as John C. Reilly. When I think of the sort of witty comebacks that the thing is throwing out during a fight scene in the comics, it does not come off as John C. Reilly delivery.
And usually
I think Michael Chiklis is the perfect kind of person for Ben Grimm.
But you also,
because he can do that kind of humor, but also have that kind of gravitas that Ben has. Yeah, so that, I still to this day hold that was excellent casting in this film.
Plus, it's one of the big things about Fantastic Four is the dynamic between Human Torch and the Thing. Is that big brother, little brother dynamic where they're kind of doing jabs at each other, fighting like brothers, but, you know, are still good friends, which you kind of get in this one with Chris Evans and Michael Chiklis.
Like, yeah,
say what you will, but Chris Evans was perfectly cast as Johnny Storm.
I'm not sure he was. I mean, I think that the reason why I did not really remember him from this movie, and when he got cast as Captain America, I was like, is there something familiar about this guy? Have I seen him in something before? Because I kind of vaguely remember his face, but we've talked before about my kind of weird face blindness. And I was like, he kind of looks familiar, and like his voice sounds a little familiar to me. And then I realized, like, oh, he's that guy who played, you know, the Human Torch in that Fantastic Four movie that wasn't very good. And the thing is that I think that Chris Evans just kind of comes off as a bit of a cinnamon roll in real life. And I think that, nothing against his acting skill or anything, but I think that kind of merges into a Steve Rogers character a little bit better for him. And I don't think it really comes across so much in the way they were trying to do Johnny Storm. In this, where he's just like the, like, hey, what's up? I'm the playboy. And, you know, like, I'm going to treat women kind of horribly. Which also, you kind of, like, yeah, Johnny Storm is a bit of a show-off in the comics, but also you like him. And I think they went a little too far with the show-off bit.
He's also supposed to be the youngest member of the team. So that does add a little bit to that chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, but in the way that they made him kind of a womanizer and stuff in this.
But it's a womanizer that works. Because he's woman, you know, he kind of comes off as that. And then it kind of works with the women. Like, there's that one.
Does it, though? I mean,
there's
the scriptwriter wants it to work. But... I mean,
he just... melts into the snow and creates a hot tub. He says, hey, you want to join me? And the girl just shrugs and just starts stripping. And he's with a different woman in almost every scene. And they're all like all fawning over him.
And yeah, like I said, the script writer wants us to think it works, but does it though?
I'm going to trust you. You're the, you know, I mean, you are a woman, so I would, trust you. I trust your judgment.
I mean, it comes across to me, you know, your mileage may vary, dear listener, but It has always come across to me as, wow, whatever man wrote this really wants us to think this is working, and it is not. So it just makes him come off as just a really unlikable guy. At least in the first movie, they kind of tone it down a little bit in the sequel, which we're not really talking about today. So I think maybe somebody pulled the screenwriters aside and was like, can we not do that? It works. Like, if you compare it to other ways, like, they're kind of, you know, like, Tony Stark in the MCU is, you know, a playboy who sleeps around. But you never really get the idea that he doesn't respect the women as humans. He just is afraid of relationships. You know? It's not that he sleeps around with women because he finds women not valuable or equal to himself. You just know that he's got issues and he's not ready to commit to a relationship. That's a him thing, not necessarily that he's a misogynist. And it's a very fine line to walk. But in this iteration of the Fantastic Four, the way they do Johnny Storm is kind of like, they have him say all kinds of weird and creepy things. Like, Ben says to him, like, oh yeah, what? There's no higher calling than money and lots of women. He's like, well, I don't know any higher calling.
But he also, when he's with the girls, he's saying, that's my future wife.
Yeah, but also, he's never with the same woman again, so is it?
Maybe in that moment he feels that way, and then he wakes up the next day and says, eh, it was just a feeling.
Yeah. Come on, dude.
Now, if you really want to talk about conquering women for the sake of conquering women, we talk about our Victor Von Doom.
Yeah. Who was apparently originally a role that Jude Law was supposed to be up for.
I can see it.
And instead we ended up with Julianne McMahon, who also a good choice, a good enough choice. I would have liked to see what Jude Law did with it, but, you know, nothing against Julianne McMahon, who does fine here.
He really puts forward the, I have everything, but I need to be petty type of billionaire. That we're kind of, I mean.
So all billionaires, you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, pick your billionaire of choice. Yeah. He even says it. I can have any woman I want. He has those GQ good looks. He's got more, as Johnny says, he has more money than God. But he needs to have Sue Storm because that's Reed Richards' ex, and he wants to stick it to him. He does this mission to stick it to Reed Richards. He is his, you know, that's one thing that I do like that this movie gets right, is the obsession with Reed Richards.
Yeah. And it's the only thing this movie gets right about Victor Von Doom. I'm just going to say it. This was my biggest sticking point with this movie when it came out. If you had been around me if we had been recording this when this movie came out, boy, would this have been just an angry rant about how they screwed up Victor Von Doom.
Okay, so we need to go into the comic books for this, and bear with me on this one for those of you who don't want comic lore. The thing about...
Who doesn't want comic lore? What kind of weirdo doesn't want comic lore?
But, you know, we need to kind of give an explanation on this one. So Victor Von Doom's whole thing in the comics was that, yes, he is a very intelligent man. He is a very rich man. He is... from a foreign land that he may or may not be a dictator of, depending on where you are in the story.
I mean, he's definitely the dictator of Latveria. Let's not kid ourselves.
I'm saying he, depending on where you are in the story, he has.
Oh, depending on where you are in the story, sometimes he loses the throne of Latveria. Yeah, okay. Or but hasn't most of the yet. Time, he's yeah.
Yeah. So like, that was the whole thing, and he is very, you know. Victor Von Doom's powers are not technology based, and they're not cosmic based. In the comics, his powers are magic based. The armor he wears, including the mask, are all made specifically to enhance his magical powers. Why does he have magical powers? Because his mother is Romani and got banished to hell. So he learned magic to get his mother out of hell. In the Marvel Comics, hell is a very real place and you can go there. I don't
this
know.
This is going to turn into another Mephisto rant, isn't it?
But obviously, this is a universe where magic does not exist that we know of. In the MCU, we have magic. So we could potentially have Victor Von Doom. Again, we are recording this before the Fantastic Four MCU movie comes out. If it's even filming yet.
Yeah.
So they might actually go into that he is magic-based villain. Here, there's no magic. So they have to find a way to give him his powers and have it make sense. By having him be involved with the same accident that created the Fantastic Four and having his body turn into metal and then having this electricity type of power to come from it. It's fine. It's not exact, but there was really no way to do magic-based powers in the movie.
Here's my issue, though, is that Dr. Doom and Victor Von Doom, his magic powers were sort of a later retcon as the Fantastic Four went on. So you don't even need him to have those magic powers this early in the story. Mm-hmm. Because the scariest thing to me always about Victor Von Doom was kind of the same thing that's scary about Lex Luthor in the Superman comics. Is that Victor Von Doom's primary power is I have money and diplomatic immunity. What are you gonna do about it? Which, in a real world context, is kind of more terrifying on a daily basis than, oh, the dude can shoot lightning out of his hands. Because that's the real terrifying thing in our world, is just a guy who has so much money and power that he's never gonna, like, even if you catch him and turn him over to the police, what are they gonna do? Nothing.
He's a diplomat.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing. He's a diplomat of a foreign nation. You can't prosecute him. He just wanders around. And that's what happens all the time in the Fantastic Four comics. Is like, Doom just shows up and does all sorts of evil stuff. And the Fantastic Four catch him and they're like, we've got you now, Doom. And somebody from the U.S. government goes, oh, we're sorry, King Doom of Latveria. We'll return you back to your home country immediately, Your Majesty. Because to do otherwise would be like war with a foreign nation, and we're not going to do that. Because that's how it works. And the Fantastic Four are always just standing there going like, Oh, yeah, right. He's the monarch of a foreign nation, and it doesn't matter how many times we capture him, he's just gonna show up again and do that, you know? And originally, like, his experiment that made him hate Reed Richards so much, yes, he was trying to get his mother out of hell, but he was trying to do it via scientific means because he hadn't honed his magic powers yet. So he was trying to use science to open the portal to hell to get his mother back, and Reed Richards kind of came in and was like, "Hey, what's this experiment you're doing?" And flipped a switch, not knowing what was going on, and ruined it, and made the thing explode, and left Doom with a scar, which was why he like put on the mask originally, and you know,
I mean, granted, a lot of this is retcon later on, but I love the
yeah.
fact that the explosion that supposedly ruined his face actually, much like in the film here, only gives him a tiny scar. And he says, "My face is ruined. How dare you? I will get you Reed Richards for this." And then he makes the suit, he gets the mask, and then he puts the mask on his face before the metal has cooled, and that is what scars him.
Yeah, it's him not being patient enough to wait for the metal to cool down that gives him the really bad scars that makes him wear the mask for later. And then later he makes the mask magic and it gives him more powers and stuff. But it's like most of Doom's stuff originally is self-inflicted, and his powers just come from the fact that he has money and diplomatic immunity. Why not just make that the original thing of like he has the most ridiculous beef against Reed Richards? Everybody knows it's ridiculous, but you can't make the guy go away because he's got money and diplomatic immunity. And
Like that
it's
would have
like,
been a that would have been a better intro to this movie than him going than them going to a, you know, Doom running a company. Like he could they could have said, "Well, we've gone to every by potential part of the U.S. government. We're gonna have to go to the U.S. embassy of left, you know, the Latvian embassy in the U.S.
but
and beg."
also, there are lots of foreign nations who have investments throughout the US. You know, it's like he can be both. He can be, you know, like, well, it's a company based in Latveria and, you know, and everything. And it just happens to be like maybe they were both sent to the same boarding school. And, you know, it happens. It's a thing that's actually happens in the real world, you know?
We only get like three mentions of Latveria in the film at all. Once is we get the mask saying that he was the Latverian Humanitarian Award. Why is a
And why do
Latverian?
you give him that creepy mask for doing like humanitarian stuff?
The second one is one of his business partners says, "Hey, you should have stayed in the old country, Latveria." And then finally the our sequel bait where Doom is in a shipping crate on a boat to Latveria.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. But that's the thing that made me the most angry about the film when it originally came out was I was like, Doom doesn't necessarily need superpowers. I mean, yes, in the comics he eventually gets them and you know, Doctor Strange is like, this dude is really good. He could have been Sorcerer Supreme if he wasn't busy, you know, being dictator of a whole country, but
There's even a story, and I love the story, is that Doom meets an alternate universe version of himself that doesn't have the obsessions, that doesn't have the ridiculous wants, needs, and ego mostly, and through his own technology and finances, create world peace on his Earth. And he is seen as a worldwide hero because he let it all go and actually became a good person and used his influence to be a good cause in the world. And the main universe, Dr. Doom, says F that and kills him.
yeah, it's like so I don't know why you needed to turn him into Colossus with lightning powers in this film. It's such a ridiculous sideswipe, you know? Like, Doom is cool enough on his own. In the original iteration, even, like, before he studies magic, he's still really awesome as a villain in those early things. Or you could have just been like, hey, Latveria's major export is Doombots, because the Doombot thing is awesome. Like, the fact that he just creates Doombots and can, you know, mess stuff up with just an army of those would have been really cool.
I mean, they could have done that, like, you know, robotics is a major export of Doom and Von Doom Corporation. He could have just made his suit be some sort of pre-Iron Man, Iron Man suit or something.
Yeah, I mean, this was before Iron Man came out, so it wasn't like anybody would be comparing it to that movie in 2005. So, you know, that would have been another way to go if you wanted to have him be, like, more of a threat and, you know, also a scientist or something, you know? But yeah, it's... I don't know. That was my big thing, was I don't think that the way they went with Dr. Doom was really that interesting or scary. The other thing is let's talk about our choice of Reed Richards here.
Mm-hmm.
Who we eventually get is Ewan Griffith, who had been in a few major films before. He started out as like a bit part in Titanic, and he had a bit part in Black Hawk Down. And just right around this same time, he was Lancelot in that King Arthur movie that had Keira Knightley in it. He had done for Disney, the Disney connection is he had a part in the 102 Dalmatians live action movie. This was kind of, I guess, his big starring role in a major film. The thing that kind of makes me annoyed as just a fangirl is apparently one of the people that had either auditioned or was on the shortlist for Reed Richards was Alexis Denizov. And we have spoken before about my love for Alexis Denizov, and I am really, really mad and wanting to go to the universe where we got Alexis Denizov as Reed Richards. I mean, he's been in the MCU now as the other, but come on. Alexis Denizov is Reed Richards. It's like, don't you want to see Wesley Wyndham Price as Reed Richards? Like, also, we could have had Mads Mikkelsen as Reed Richards, apparently, at one point, which I think would have been really a bizarre choice, and I'm kind of glad we didn't go that direction. No offense to Mads Mikkelsen, who I absolutely love, but I do not think he is correct for that part. Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of living in the... I want to go to the universe where we had Jeffrey Combs as Doctor Strange and Alexis Denizov as Reed Richards. That's the universe I was supposed to be born in. But I'm not gonna say that Ewan Griffith did like a bad job here. He was all right.
It's one of the better attempts at a European doing an American accent.
Yeah, he's fine. I mean, for a Welsh guy doing an American accent, okay. The way I knew he was Welsh was he has a Welsh name. Like, it's like, I looked at the credits and went, oh, okay. He's fine, but the thing is, the writing does not give Reed, like, anything to do.
But it does fall into a lot of the tropes of Reed Richards from the comic. I need to cure Ben. I need to be the guy that's ringing everyone back from their own personalities. But I also have to be an a-hole because I'm too smart for my own good.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that Reed Richards has never been one of my favorite Marvel characters. his personality is like himself, so flexible depending on who's writing it, that I'm not really sure you can really describe it to people. It just changes so wildly depending on who's there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they've ever really pinned down who Reed Richards is as a character. And the same for Sue Storm. I think she's a very difficult character to write. And in this one, they've kind of made her, you know, a geneticist who's working for Von Doom Corp. You know?
Who may or may not be dating Victor.
Well, she says at the end of the movie that she never did.
Victor seemed to think otherwise, but that's Victor being Victor.
Yeah, I mean, she says that they never did, you know?
They never did anything.
Yeah.
I will say this. I appreciate the attempt to, you know, giving Sue more to do. You know, and actually going into her personality of being the overlooked one, overlooked by Reed, overlooked by Victor, either one taking their credit for her idea or whatever. At least that is how the script is playing it. But I cannot believe Jessica Alba in the role. I never could. That was my only issue with the movie. Jessica Alba is a fine actress, but at this point in her career, she was always playing the hot chick.
Which is all they wanted her to be here. Like, her geneticist thing was, once again, you kind of just feel like it was like, oh, people are going to get mad at us if we use the original comic story here, because honestly, the original comic story is only two people were supposed to be on that space mission, and it was supposed to be Reed, because he was the scientist, and Ben, because he was the pilot. They knew that an audience in 2005 wouldn't buy the story of Sue as Reed's girlfriend would just like walk up and be like, "Aw, but you know, my little brother has always wanted to see space, and I think it would be really peachy keen too if I got to ride on a spaceship. Can we please just tag along?" Which is kind of what happens in the first comic. Because they aren't going up to explore a storm. They're just like going up for a test ride or something. And then the storm hits them and it's a surprise. But in the movie, they're going up to do like, we're going up to actually study this storm. And so we know we're going to be in some form of danger, so everybody that's up there needs to have a reason to be up there, except for maybe Von Doom, but he's just rich. And he owns the space station, so we can't tell him no.
Comic Von Doom would never sully his hands by being up there on his own.
Yeah, exactly. But
he needed to be up there for plot reasons.
And because he wanted to propose to Sue on the space station with the view of the Earth and stuff. Which, I gotta admit, that is kind of awesome. Like, I don't know. That might get me as a proposal. Like, you'd have to be really, really scummy for me to be like, I don't know, you brought me all the way up to space to propose. but, I mean... You would, in that case, have to be a billionaire, and there's no way I'm marrying a billionaire, so yeah, that still wouldn't work. You're right. Anyway, sorry. But, so they had to give everybody a reason to be up there, but at no other point in the movie does she really do anything that's like, oh yeah, you're actually like a geneticist.
You yeah. know? I mean, and the excuse to get Jessica Alba in her underwear.
Well, the thing is that to me is so ridiculous, because once they realize that the unstable molecules in their suits have been exposed to the radiation as well, and therefore have the same properties that they do, Johnny, in the only smart move that he has in the entire film, just starts wearing that suit under his day clothes all the time in case he bursts into flame. Because he bursts into flame a couple of times and his clothes burn off and he's left in awkward positions without his clothing. Mm-hmm. Which is just the movie wanting to show Chris Evans without his clothing, which, you know, okay, fine. But very quickly they're like, okay, he's smart enough to realize, like, oh, this is the one piece of clothing that won't burn up. I'll just start wearing that under my t-shirt and jeans. Problem solved. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Sue keeps running into the problem of, I need to use my invisibility, and I keep having to take my clothes off, which leads to the awkward thing of me suddenly being naked in awkward situations and having to leave my underwear on New York City streets. I have a piece of clothing that will turn invisible with me. Does she wear it under her clothes except for like three scenes in the movie? No, she does not. Why? Because the male writers wanted her to keep being in situations where she has to leave her underwear in random situations on New York City streets.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
She's the geneticist.
She's supposed to be a scientist, and yeah.
Yeah.
But I do like, I mean, it's kind of played up in the movie, how I tend to call Reed the world's dumbest genius. And I think that kind of got infectious to the other characters.
And the thing is like, both Jessica Alba and Chris Evans, very attractive people.
True.
But who is the one that gets the point in the film where something happens to their clothing because of their superpowers, and another character has to remark, like, oh, wow, you've been working out?
Yeah, I mean, that also plays into the Reed-Sue love angle. And, you know, at first, they play it off like, here comes Sue. She's wearing her suit, and her cleavage is half sticking out, that she intentionally does because she wants Reed's attention. And Rita said, oh, wow, these suits are amazing. Which is a Reed line. Reed would definitely be more concerned with the material of the suit than the woman with half her cleavage popping out.
And also, Reed respects women. Good for Reed. Depending who the writer is. He thinks she's dating another guy.
Which apparently Sue is angry about.
Because this movie is written by men.
Like she says, you know, Victor fought for what he wanted. You don't. And Ben says, you know, several of the characters always comment, you're always thinking about doing something, but you never do something.
So if you are not dating Victor and you want to date Reed, just go, Reed, I'm not dating Victor. Do you want to go out to dinner?
They've said, and they mentioned that. Their first date, she asks him. Because when they were in college together, he didn't think she was into him. Until she said something.
Like, you've dated the man long enough to know he doesn't pick up on subtle signals. Just walk up to him and be like, I think you think I'm dating Reed. I'm dating Victor. I'm not dating Victor. You want to go out to dinner? I still like you.
And they have played that up in the comics, alternate universe versions. And yes, Fanforstic plays that up as well. But in this movie, it's more of he's more of a into the science side of everything versus anything else. So Reed being more concerned with the materials of the suits versus the one with her cleavage out, and then later commenting about Sue's figure when he really wouldn't.
I mean, I'm not saying that he wouldn't comment on it later, but like maybe not in that moment,
yeah.
In that moment where it's kind of inappropriate and he knows she's embarrassed and like they're in the middle of, you know,
New York City.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in a more private moment, like there's that moment where he catches her in the shower or whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
or like, you know, somewhere around the house because they're living together or something, like that's a more appropriate moment to write in that joke ? But I think that is the thing that a lot of people at the time, like if you go back and listen to critics and what people were saying when this film came out, that, you know, Marvel Comics have always been funny. And even when films started coming out, the Marvel films, even before, you know, the MCU and the DCEU, Marvel films tended to be more comedic and lighthearted than the same stuff that was made off of DC properties. But the humor in this was wildly out of tone for me. And I think it was for a lot of people, because I remember, you know, watching movie critics on like morning shows and stuff when they still used to do that, and people saying like, you know, parts of it were good, and when they got down to like the actual superhero stuff, it was better, but then it would just go into like weird comedy bits, and I don't know why they did that. And rewatching it, I was like, oh yeah, I forgot that there's just some really weird ass comedy bits in this. And to me, it doesn't really fit the tone of either Marvel or Fantastic Four. Thing is sitting there having a moment, and a pigeon thinks he's a statue and poops on him. Like, why is that there?
I mean, he's already at his low point. I guess they want to make him lower. I don't know. And they follow this up with the big drama moment of Ben's girlfriend. You know, he tries, you know, he makes it, you know, he says, you know, hey, you said we'd be together forever, no matter what happens. Well, and then, you know, she leaves the engagement ring on the ground and walks away from him because she can't stand the way he looks.
And instead of just letting that moment be the moment of like, his girlfriend is so awful, she breaks up with him at the moment of his biggest triumph when everybody is clapping for him, they then undercut that moment with like, oh look, his fingers are so big now that he can't even pick up the ring from the ground. It's like, insult the injury, are we supposed to laugh at that? Or like, you know, because it's earlier was played as a comedic moment because he couldn't dial the phone on the payphone. The numbers on the payphone because of his fingers. And that was supposed to be a laugh. And then they reused the same thing a couple of minutes later with him not being able to grab the ring. And then they use it a few minutes later with him not being able to pick up the fork to eat his food. So is that supposed to be a laugh? Because if so, it's really inappropriate and undercuts the emotion of the moment.
Mm.
So why is that? Is that trying to make us laugh at his pain? Because I don't want to do that. I am feeling for him because that's a horrific moment. And I like Ben. And I don't want to watch him go through that.
And in the comics, it's played up, as you said, it's played up as this tragic moment. And he is a tragic character. Yes, he is a hero. Yes, he is loved. But it's also very tragic that he cannot live a normal life. He cannot go to a freaking ball game. Because even if he wasn't a hero, his disfigurement, for lack of a better term, is getting all eyes on him. He can't enjoy normal life.
It's really, you know, the Thing is a great hero and everybody loves him. He's the ever-loving Thing, but his ability to have a normal life, you know, Johnny has these superpowers, but he's also still the ladies' man, and you know, he's still the cute young guy, and you know, Reed and Storm have their superpowers, but they're still a couple. They're, you know, married very quickly in the comic, and they end up having children, and they end up, you know, but like Ben's story is he was the one that was in a happy, stable relationship, and he goes up into space. And he comes back down, and the one point of stability in his life is immediately ripped away from him. And while everybody else has the family structure, you know, I mean, Johnny and Sue are brother and sister, so they already have that built-in bond. And Reed and Sue are romantically linked, and they have that stability. Ben is the best friend, and while they do consider him family, he doesn't really have anybody else beyond, you know, the camaraderie of the Fantastic Four. And what he did have, he lost becoming part of the Fantastic Four, and it is a really tragic moment in the comics. And they keep finding ways to undercut it in the film. And I hate that. Like, why do you keep doing that? Why can't you just let the moment be?
Yeah. And yeah. people have said that about modern MCU movies. And like, you don't know how bad we had it back then. With this movie.
Well, it was one of my problems with Thor: Love and Thunder, is that the editing of that movie, and I don't know who made those choices in the end, but the editing of that movie, you know, there's a lot of serious stuff they're dealing with in that movie.
Cancer.
Yeah. You know, I mean, cancer for one thing, but there's a lot of other serious things that they're dealing with, you know, and so much of that movie is like, we're gonna have a really harsh moment where we're talking about, you know, the loss of a child or cancer or, you know, how all of our people have had to leave their homeland and come to a different place or, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, bleeding goat meme out of nowhere, or whatever weird joke is just gonna wander through in the moment, and you're like, could we have not just had like two or three more seconds to let that moment, you know, resonate and sit with that, because that's a really heavy moment, you know. The thing about this film is that they're not really having those bits where the heroes are coming to grips with who they are now. I mean, they kind of do a bit of a montage, but except for Ben having to go like, oh, you know, I just lost my fiance and now everybody stares at me weird. The other three don't really have to deal too much with their powers making them different from everybody else. There's that little moment where Sue has the I'm a celebrity now and people want to take my picture and get me out of here.
Yeah. They do play that up. I mean, it is from the comics as well, where they go from, you know, there's that line that Reed says, we're scientists, not celebrities. And that is from the comic as well, where they suddenly thrust into being celebrities and they don't like it. And Johnny just revels in the idea of being this celebrity and everyone else was, you know, this is not what we signed up for. But
Johnny definitely wants to be the celebrity. Please take my picture. Please give me sponsorships. Let me do, you know, motocross or whatever.
Let me get all the women.
Yeah.
One of the things apparently that they took for inspiration for this movie was, of all things, the Beatles movie Hard Day's Night. In terms of celebrities can have a public life. Every time they are in the public eye, they're swamped with fans.
I think the second film does it a little bit better. Spoilers for that, because it starts out with Reed and Sue trying to get married, and it's, you know, a media circus, and, you know, helicopters are flying around trying to get pictures of the venue and all that kind of stuff. And there's fans outside at a cordon holding signs and cameras and stuff. And it's treated very much like the royal wedding kind of feel, with people lined up trying to get pictures of, you know, who's attending the wedding. And the second film, I think, kind of does it better in the fact that they can't have a normal life. But this one, they try a little bit, but I don't think it really grasps it as well.
Outside of that one scene with Sue, where she's just trying to buy a newspaper and then see her face all over every magazine and then getting swamped with people, that's kind of the extent of that we see.
Yeah. And that would have been the moment to maybe be wearing your suit under your clothing. Just saying. They have the whole bit about, like, what exactly is Doom's plan towards the end of the movie?
Kill Reed Richards. That is always Reed's plan. No matter what storyline, from the comics to every adaptation, What's Victor's plan? Kill Reed Richards.
Yeah, but the thing is that it's so ridiculous in this one. You can kind of sort of understand it in the comics because it's still ridiculous, but you can sort of see how Victor would think that what happens is Reed's fault. But in this one, it's like, what exactly does Reed... I mean, what exactly does Victor think Reed did? Like, they're Reed on the station, and Victor is closing the shields.
Reed doesn't stop him.
Well, yeah, but it's not like Reed created the shields. Victor created the shields, if memory serves. It's Victor's, you know, station. Victor keeps going, the shields will protect us, you know? Victor is closing the shields. Reed doesn't say, he kind of says, don't close the shields. Victor does it anyway.
And then he turns it around later in the movie. Even though he was the one that said the shields will protect us, later in the movie he says, well, Reed said the shields will protect us. Look what happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just, like, the whole thing is kind of a mess where, like, nothing Doom does at any point during this movie actually makes sense?
I think it's not supposed to. Because, you know, it's that jealousy from Reed. Reed was always the smartest one. Reed had Sue first. Reed took his TV time away. You know, when he came back, he wanted to be this great scientific hero, and he was going to get on all the TV networks and get all this work for his company. And now it's Reed that is on TV. Reed is on the magazines. Everyone's talking about the Fantastic Four, and he loses all of his own endorsements and is almost kicked out of his own company.
And the only reason that that happens is because Victor comes back and goes, well, you suck, instead of going, look, the Fantastic Four are on the Doom payroll. We've paid off all the debt of the Baxter building so that they can do the thing. Like, all he had to do was just be like, yeah, look at this great new asset to my company that happened on my space station. Yay!
Doom would never do that. Doom would never do that, though, because that's giving Reed credit for something.
The thing is like, Reed never wants credit for anything. He just wants the science. He would let Doom take credit. And that's the thing, Doom never understands in situations like these. Just be a little smarter, man. Come on.
As I said, that requires letting go of his ego, which he cannot do. If he would just let go of his ego.
He gets to keep his ego. Look, it's the Fantastic Four, brought to you by Doom. That's all you gotta do. Like, you can slap your name on everything they do.
I think, but, like, you know, he doesn't want their name above his. Even if it's Doom Presents the Fantastic Four, that's not good enough. I don't know. Again, it doesn't make sense, but it's not supposed to, because Doom's grudge against Reed doesn't make sense. It only makes sense to Victor Von Doom. And that's enough for him.
I'm like, trying to help you out, man. I really am. Bring me on as your PR. Latveria could be ruling the world.
He would have killed you off in 5 minutes. Because you told him no.
Could try.
We've seen that billionaires don't like getting told no.
Who says I would tell him no? You just got to tell them yes in a way that makes it think that it was their idea. The other thing that bugged me about this movie, and it bugged me again on the rewatch, is that the thing about the Fantastic Four, and one of the reasons it was created, is because Marvel wanted to create a family team. And they were family in different kinds of ways. Like we said, you know, Sue and Johnny are brother and sister, so they are blood relation. Reed and Sue are related by eventual marriage, so romantically related there, and eventually, you know, legally related by marriage. But then Ben is related to the rest of the team simply because he's chosen family. You know, he is their best friend. Reed's best friend, and then eventually the rest of the team as well. So it's showing all different types of family connection. You know, blood bond, marriage bond, chosen bond. They're a family. And this movie forgets that so hardcore.
That is what I said last week about The Incredibles, that at the end of the day, this is still a family, and the Incredibles never forget that. And that is one of the biggest problems about every adaptation of the Fantastic Four, is that they forget that at the end of the day, these four people are family. They are family first, superhero second. But the spectacle of superheroes, the spectacle of powers, the spectacle of special effects, overrides that in these adaptations. So it's like, I'm crossing my fingers in every other appendage I have that when the MCU finally gets their Fantastic Four movie done, that they will remember that these four people are supposed to be family. First and foremost, they are a family.
The only thing that they do in this film is just fight with each other. Like, from the moment the film starts, they're fighting with each other. And it doesn't really stop until, like, the last scene. And then it's like, oh yeah, I guess we're going to be the Fantastic Four. We're a family now.
The first time we ever get the mention of the family is from Doom, before he sends a rocket at them. Oh, I'm going to take care of the rest of your family. Some of the bickering makes sense because you have Sue and Johnny, brother and sister. Yes, they fight. Siblings fight. But I think these two take it a little too far. They fight a little too much to be convincing as brother and sister. And then you have the, like I said, the dynamic between Johnny and Ben. They're always taking jabs at each other. But they were always friendly jabs. In this one, Johnny's jabs are a little bit more on the cruel side. Especially when they do that parody of the Joker mirror scene from Batman. And it's a nice fake out. I give him the credit for the fake out. But as in terms of, you know, I can't believe it, what happened to your face? Give me the mirror. And then it's like, he's just normal. They couldn't fix your face, man.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more crueler than it's supposed to be between those two.
And the scene where he's giving them all names, you know, like naming the members of the team at the motocross stadium. You know, he's just like, oh yeah, we just call him the Thing, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, it would have been better if it was like on She-Hulk, where somebody just named them and they were like, well, okay, fine, whatever, that's just what they're calling us now, we don't really like it, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, before Johnny even says, that's the Invisible Girl, like, there, people are already calling her the Invisible Woman. Like, in that scene where she's trying to buy the newspaper. Hey, it's the Invisible Woman.
Yeah, which is, you know, a later name for the character. The thing is, like, it would have been better, I think, for the media to just come up with names for them and then being like, well, okay, I guess they stuck.
We get the thing is, the media is already calling Reed Richards Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's all we get.
But, you know, the way Johnny names them is kind of cruel for all of them. Not just at Ben. Like, Ben gets it worse. But the things he says around it about Reed and Sue as well. And then they show up and they're just yelling at him publicly with cameras and stuff around.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you guys remember you're supposed to be a family. Like, if you want to have a scene later when they get back to the Baxter building and they're like, hey Johnny, we need to talk to you about your behavior, that's a legitimate thing to put in the movie. But I just cannot imagine, like, I mean, not necessarily, because I'm with as many people who have written the comics over this many decades, I'm sure a similar thing has happened. But it just feels not in tone for most of the run of the Fantastic Four for them to just berate a member like that.
Publicly?
Publicly. With news cameras and stuff around. Over kind of petty drama.
And it turns into a fight. So there's media there, and the Fantastic Four are fighting with each other.
Yeah. So if you want to have, like, a scene back in the Baxter building where they're talking to Johnny about his behavior, fair. But to have it be like, you know, the Thing throws Johnny into a Burger King billboard, you know.
At least it being a motocross event is the explanation for the blatant product placement.
Yeah, that was also really cheap, but at least, okay. Yeah. And then there's there's other parts too where they're just publicly hashing out things and everything, and the way that they kind of snipe at each other. And you know, if you want to show that Reed and Sue are kind of having a rocky time in their relationship, but the way that they interact with each other didn't really feel that true to what's been established mostly with their characters, you know?
And I'm not really buying the romantic angle between them either.
Yeah, it really felt like they got together at the end of the movie because they were supposed to get together at the end of the movie rather than there was any real attraction between them. Honestly, the 20 or 30 seconds between Ben and Alicia had more chemistry than Reed and Sue's entire relationship in this movie.
Ooh, great segue. And we could talk about Alicia. Yes,
Alicia. I love Kerry Washington's portrayal of Alicia in this film and in the sequel as well.
Alicia, Ben's blind girlfriend. Again, character from the comics. They did change her to a black woman for this movie, which I'm okay with, but, you know, modern, you know, put your own little argument for the modern audiences here and not like,
which fortunately wasn't as loud in 2005 as it has become now.
Social media wasn't a big thing back then. 2000, it existed. You and I were both on social media. That's how we became friends.
Yeah,
but it wasn't everybody putting their thoughts in the ether. Social media as it is today.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were some hardcore comic fans complaining about Alicia being race swapped, but it doesn't bother me in the movie because it doesn't really matter. All that matters is, you know, if Alicia wasn't blind, that would be a bigger problem because the whole point is that she is blind. She cannot see what Ben looks like. So her only, yes, she can feel his rocky face, but she falls in love with the man inside, the personality, the kind heart of that ever-loving blue-eyed thing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that she is, they don't really get into it that much in either of the two movies they made with this cast, but she is, in the comics, a sculptor. And once she feels you the way that she feels Ben's face and, you know, chest and stuff in the movie, she can sculpt a really accurate likeness. And so in the comics, they show that she has done sculptures of all of the Fantastic Four and, you know, several other heroes that she's met. But
someone called Lionel Richie.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really cool, you know, the stuff that she creates in the comics. So she creates lots of sculptures of Ben, especially throughout their relationship. You know, the way Kerry Washington plays her, even just in the tiny little amount of screen time she has in this film, is so wonderful. I love her portrayal. And her and Michael Chiklis have just immediate chemistry in this movie. Immediately buy this relationship and you're like, oh, that's gonna be his girlfriend.
Yeah, definitely more than our two leads. And, you know, no Mole Man to get in the way.
Yeah. That's true. And honestly, Chris Evans has more chemistry with every random chick that walks past him in this film than the two leads.
Yeah.
I really hate to say it, but it just is true. Him and that nurse in that one scene.
The one he goes skiing with, yeah.
Yeah, the one he goes skiing with are a more believable couple to get married at the end of the movie than Reed and Sue.
Yeah.
It's just they do not give any real time to building that relationship. They just expect the viewer to be like, oh, they were married in the comics, so I guess they're like a couple.
Because this is a Marvel movie, we got to talk about our Stan Lee cameo. And Stan Lee playing Willie Lumpkin, the ever-loving, very kind mailman for the Baxter Building, a character from the comic that, if you've ever seen Willie Lumpkin in a comic book, is the spitting image of Stan Lee. So
yeah, perfect cameo for Stan for this movie. And, loved it.
It's one of the few times where if Stan Lee had to play a character from the comics, Willie the Mailman was the perfect character for him to play.
Yeah. We do get another cameo in this film that if you've only ever seen the theatrical cut, you will have never seen this cameo. Because Hugh Jackman is in this movie, but you only ever see him if you can find a copy of the extended cut of the film.
Which we did not watch. We watched the theatrical cut that's on Disney Plus.
Yeah, Disney Plus has the theatrical cut, so you know you have to find the scene separately if you only have access to it on Disney Plus. But there is a scene where, you know, Reed is trying to get, you know, Sue to, you know, he's trying to have a romantic moment with Sue, and he uses his powers to change his face to look like Wolverine.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman plays Wolverine in that scene. He's not playing Hugh Jackman. He's playing Logan.
So I don't know why Reed was like, well, you know, everybody's like really into Wolverine. Wolverine's hot these days. Because, like, yeah, in the real world,
Hugh Jackman is a hot guy, yeah.
Hugh Jackman is supposed to be hot, but in the Marvel universe that the X-Men are in, there's not really a thing of everybody being like, well, you know that Wolverine, he's a hottie. Like, that's not really a thing everybody talks about, you know?
I mean, so, comic book Wolverine is short and hairy and not Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, he's an angry short king, but, you know, even taking out the short king status from, you know, the Marvel films, like, the only person who's really supposed to be attracted to Wolverine is, like, you know, Jean Grey in the Marvel, you know, stuff.
And, you know, Deadpool, depending on how he feels that day.
But Deadpool, the cool thing about Deadpool is just supposed to be attracted to everybody.
Yeah.
The cool thing about Deadpool is Deadpool would probably be attracted to you if you ever met Deadpool. So, you know, thumbs up for Deadpool. But so I don't really know why in the context of that scene Reed would be like, you know what would get Sue going right now? That angry guy that works with the X-Men.
This does imply that the X-Men and the Fantastic Four exist in the same universe. And there was plans. I mean, there have been talk for about 20 years of doing a Fantastic Four X-Men crossover movie. And it never happened.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, the MCU was not the first attempt at a connected Marvel universe. It's just the first one that actually worked. If people remember, there was a very unfortunate and massive email leak from the Sony studios. some years back that caused a lot of problems and several firings. And that revealed that they had been working on taking the Marvel properties that they owned, mostly from the Spider-Man lineage, and making that into a multi-movie interconnected franchise, much like what we now know as the MCU. Mm-hmm. And that would have been prior to the MCU actually really existing as we know it now. So had that worked, Sony would have gotten there first.
And at this point, Fox had X-Men, Fantastic Four, and a Daredevil movie in the works.
Well, I mean, the trailers for this film were shown in front of, I believe it was Elektra.
So Fox had X-Men, Fantastic Four, and Daredevil, and there was always those rumors of those characters interacting, even before the MCU became a thing. And there was rumors, there were some thoughts, and, you know, people at Fox said, well, we're thinking about it, we haven't found the right story yet. I mean, the big one was that they were going to take the first class X-Men and cross them over with the Fantastic cast, and then both movies didn't do as well as they had hoped, so those plans got scrapped.
The thing is that it was very likely that I mean, everybody was planning to do a Marvel interconnected thing. We had three different studios right about the same time trying to launch a Marvel universe of films. It was just a race to see who was going to get there first. And Marvel Studios, which was the newest kid on the block, with the help of the buyout from Disney, was the one who got there first. Which is not where the betting money was at the time. So it's very interesting that that happened, because that was the longest shot.
Yeah, no one thought, even when Iron Man came out, no one thought that movie was going to be a success. No one thought, oh, we're going to make an Avengers movie. Well, who's going to go see the Avengers movie when we have the X-Men movie? We have the Fantastic Four movie.
Well, and also they were like, we're going to make an Avengers movie. Oh, really? When's that going to happen? 10 years from now. That's what was on the table when we heard about the Avengers movie. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to make an Avengers movie, but first we're going to make, you know, six Iron other Man movies.
Yeah.
To set up the Avengers movie, you're going to have to wait 10 years for the Avengers movie to see if it's any good. And if you don't like the six movies that come before it, you're not getting that Avengers movie. You know, that's a massive gamble. But at the same time, like, the reason we never got the Sinister Six movie or the X-Men meets Fantastic Four meets Daredevil movie is because, you know, all those other movies kind of sucked.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say it, but, like, you know, let's get to the question, because we've kind of talked around it. Does this movie have the magic?
Parts do, but not enough for me to say yes. It's of the two Fantastic Four movies that were actually released to the public, this is the better one, but that's not saying a lot. That's there's an old saying, the late great legendary wrestling manager Bobby the Brain Heenan once said, it's like comparing ice cream to horse manure.
Yeah. I mean, comparing this to Fantastic, this is the better one. You know?
This is ice cream. It's fine little snack, but you're not going to want it every day. Fantastic, horse manure.
Yeah. I mean, they got some things right about the Fantastic Four. I'd rather watch this and its sequel than the other version that Fox attempted to make. But I'm really, really holding out hope that now that Marvel has the rights back under, you know, Feige and them, we're finally going to get something that we don't cringe at when we talk about that.
I mean,
and I'm glad that Chris Evans got another shot at a Marvel character.
Yeah.
And he almost didn't do it. Man, did he deserve that.
He almost didn't do it. Thank you, Scarlett Johansson, for convincing him to go to that audition.
Yeah, no. Perfect Steve Rogers. Not the greatest Johnny Storm.
I mean, and we already, you know, we've had Mr. Fantastic back in Multiverse of Madness. It wasn't too bad. Go back to our Multiverse of Madness episode and we'll talk about that. One final thing I will say that I did love that you don't necessarily see in a Marvel movie, a credit to Jack Kirby.
Yeah, I mean, like, shout out to Jack Kirby, yeah. Yeah,
all the Marvel movies get characters created by Stan Lee. It's like, this movie credited Jack Kirby because he is just as much a father of the Fantastic Four than Stan Lee is. Probably more so.
Yeah, and I'm gonna say that also, looking back, these special effects suck.
Yeah, especially the stretching effects of Reed.
And honestly, at the time, they sucked too. Like, people were mocking these effects in 2005. So, but they do not hold up at all. Except for, you know, the thing makeup, which was, you know, practical.
The prosthetics
work,
yeah. So
that holds up pretty good.
Yeah. So, let's move on to next week. So, Kiki, there's a movie that should be out by the time this episode is released, and, well, don't know how to say it, so I'm just gonna say it. Next week, Kiki, we are doing the Super Mario movie!
That's not owned by Disney, I don't think.
Oh, you're talking about the new one with the Illumination? No. I'm talking about the 1993 Super Mario movie with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo. Apparently, Disney owns this movie.
I'm not sure if that's better or worse for us.
I feel we're going down a slippery slope from Incredibles to Fantastic Four to Super Mario Brothers, but we're gonna try anyway. So, yeah, let's take a look at this attempt at to make a video game movie. I don't think we've talked about much about adaptations about video games in this show yet. So, yeah, after none of us have seen the new film yet. I haven't anyway.
No.
So we're going to go back and see what the first attempt at a Super Mario movie would have been like. Come down the warp pipe with us next week and feel our pain.
Wahoo.
And we'll talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye. Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.
If you want to help the fight for human rights in the U.S., the American Civil Liberties Union works to protect constitutional rights for all Americans. Their website is aclu.org. If you need reproductive services in the U.S. or wish to donate to those who do, go to abortionfunds.org for more info. The battle isn't over until the last person surrenders. The fight continues.